Hi, this is Key. I'm here with Dr. Kento Hiroshi. Thank you for spending some time with us to chat about gastric cancer. So I wanted to start with a very simple introductory question. So how do you usually see these patients referred to you? How do they present? And then how do you begin your workup?
All right, so when we talk about gastric cancer, let's just specify that we're talking about gastric adenocarcinoma. Now, these patients, unlike patients, say, in Japan or in Asia, where there's a screening test for gastric cancer, we generally get these patients not at an early stage. So early stage gastric cancer is a relatively rare thing that we see, although we see it occasionally. So most of these patients will be symptomatic by the time they get diagnosed. Most common symptoms would be GI bleeding, either hematemesis or melena, anemia, asymptomatic anemia. Some of them have pain, some of them chronic ulcer disease, some have other complaints like nausea, vomiting, or even acutely as perforation. Okay, so I think probably you know, any kind of systematic approach to these patients in your head before you actually see these patients in clinic is good, and I think that probably applies to any patient you see in clinic. So, you know, I mean, I think you can structure it in terms of history, physical, imaging, and labs. So I think the first thing is assessment of how they present and what their symptoms are, because a lot of these patients have advanced disease, and how you treat those patients, you know, for example, if they're metastatic, will depend highly upon their symptoms. So, you know, do they have bleeding? Have they had transfusions? Have they had multiple admissions for bleeding, for example, in which case you would potentially want to palliate that bleeding? Or are they obstructed? Or do they have nausea and vomiting and an inability to take POs? Or even, you know, as I mentioned, you know, do they have evidence of perforation? I had one patient who had metastatic gastric cancer come in with a huge perforation that wasn't amenable to any kind of drainage, and we had to do an acute total gastrectomy. So those are considerations of what the symptoms are. And then, of course, overall performance status of the patient and comorbidities and their surgical candidacy are things that you want to assess in just about any patient you're considering surgery on. Having said that, then the next kind of considerations are, as you approach with any cancer patient, is number one, the diagnosis, whether you have a diagnosis and what the diagnosis is. And number two, stage. So make the diagnosis and then stage a tumor. I think those are basically you know, a general consideration for any cancer patient. So how do you make the diagnosis? It's easy in cancer. You need tissue. How was the tissue obtained? And do you have pathologic confirmation? Is there any uncertainty? And what are the characteristics on the path? Is it poorly differentiated? Is there signet ring cell type? You know, those are all things that partially affect their prognosis. This is one of the cases where you want to see the endoscopy report. You want to see the pictures from the endoscopy, because the location of the tumor is going to be key. Is it in the antrum? Is it prepyloric? Is it by the gastroesophageal junction? Is this a GE junction tumor? In which case, this Sievert classification applies, you know, 1, 2, and 3, with 1 being more distal esophagus infiltrating into the GE junction, 2 being right at the GE junction, and 3 being at the cardia, sort of involving the GE junction. So that will shape your operative strategy significantly if it's proximal versus distal versus in the body, whether it's small, whether it's flat, whether it's infiltrative, whether it's you know, more of a nodular, whether it's associated with an ulcer. Those are all things that you need to know from the endoscopy. And a lot of these patients have had come with you with treatment on board, or some have, and so you want the pre-treatment endoscopy. That's going to be key. So that gives you diagnosis and location, and then staging. So the next thing is, you know, assessing the T stage and the N stage and the M stage, obviously. So T and M stage, I find, is probably best done with endoscopic ultrasound, and that's pretty much standard. PET CT is an option, you know, on the NCCN guidelines, it is acceptable to do a PET CT. Medical oncologists like them a lot because they can follow therapy with them. You can look at the FDG avidity of the primary lesion in response to chemotherapy. For surgical purposes, it's not as useful because it doesn't give as much anatomic detail, I found. So good quality CT chest, abdomen, pelvis is going to give you certainly any gross evidence of metastatic disease. The PET may pick up on other occult disease that's not picked up on CT. The problem is, if there's not an anatomic correlate to the PET, it's going to be hard to sort of put someone in a certain stage diagnosis. For example, say the PET lights up something small in the liver, but there's no anatomic correlate on a good quality CT scan. It's going to be really hard to call that patient M1. It's going to be hard to biopsy it if you can't see it on CT scan. So you know, the pet has some increased sensitivity, but so practically speaking, from a surgical perspective, it doesn't add too much. Having said that, it's not wrong to get a PET CT. So CT chest, abdomen, pelvis. Now, if that shows obvious metastatic disease, then the endoscopic ultrasound is made relatively moot. So say they have ascites, omental nodularity, they have multiple liver mets, then endoscopic ultrasound really isn't going to change your management. That's M1 disease. If there's absence of metastatic disease, then you want to stage it locally, because that would potentially change your therapy. So those are the kinds of things I'm looking for when I go in to see the patient. I want to know what their symptoms are. I want to know the comorbidities, the performance status, and I want to know how it was diagnosed. I want to see the endoscopy report. I want to see any CT scan imaging. I want the chest and the abdomen and pelvis, because a lot of these patients up by the cardia or the GE junction can metastasize to mediastinal or thoracic nodes. If they've had therapy, I want to know what therapy they've had. I want to know how long it's been since their last chemotherapy. I want to see how they've tolerated it, and I want to see it restaged after therapy. So, repeat endoscopy as well as repeat CT chest, abdomen, pelvis, and or PET scan if they've had a PET scan. I think those would be the main things. I think in terms of laboratory values, there's not really any tumor markers that we follow. You want just a sort of basic set of labs, check their anemia, make assessment of their nutritional status, weight loss, PO intake, albumin. A lot of these patients have nutritional issues. And then obviously family history. There is a familial syndrome of gastric cancer. It's associated with a germline mutation in the ecadherin, what encodes for the ecadherin protein. Those patients tend to have early gastric cancer, or gastric cancer at an early stage, or early age. So I think that's roughly kind of the initial evaluation. So
great. So thank you, Dr. Rossi. So from that information, how do you decide whether you should start with medical or surgical treatment? And if you do go down the medical arm first, or in general, if there's a chemotherapy of some kind involved, how you decide whether it's better to do it neoadjuvant or adjuvant?
Yeah, so this is basically where I think your algorithm serves you well. So in general, when you treat cancer overall, you want to have kind of a stage-specific treatment in your strategy. So start off easy, I think, for metastatic disease. If you clear metastatic disease, then you're in a palliative setting. This is not going to be curable disease. And so any intervention that you make is in the palliative setting. And so surgery, in that sense, is going to be purely palliative. And that means you want to address symptoms. So if there is significant bleeding history, that is an adverse effect on quality of life, then you would consider potentially a palliative gastrectomy in that situation. Having said that, total gastrectomy is not a very effective palliative operation. In general, the decrease in the quality of life is significant, and any recovery, when people look at GI-related health quality of life with a specific instrument to measure that, the health-related quality of life after total gastrectomy does not improve from pre-op until about 6 months. The median survival of someone with metastatic gastric cancer is around that range. So if someone is asymptomatic from their gastric cancer, there's really no advantage to doing a total gastrectomy. In other words, you don't do it sort of prophylactically to prevent symptoms. So that's in the metastatic setting, and otherwise it's pretty much systemic therapy is the therapy for metastatic disease. Then non-metastatic disease, you probably want to break down into two categories. One is very early gastric cancer, and the second would be sort of more local regional disease. And by that, I would probably divide it by T2 and under, and node negative disease would be early, and T2 and or higher, and node positive disease would put you in more local regional disease. So, and in the early gastric cancer patients, so this would be T1 plus minus T2, you would consider upfront resection in those patients. We don't talk about endoscopic mucosal resection or endoscopic sort of local excision in this country too much. It's done more in Asia, just because it's very rare we see these patients, and it's just not a It's not a very well-developed sort of practice here. So it's a question, I suppose, if you have a T1 lesion, you could consider endoscopic resection, but typically we would resect those patients. So node negative, T2 or lower patients, and that's staged by endoscopic ultrasound usually. Node positive disease, typically you would consider a neoadjuvant approach for these patients. Most of that is directed by, the evidence for that is directed by the MAGIC trial, which is a trial of perioperative chemotherapy in adenocarcinoma of the stomach, non-metastatic adenocarcinoma of the stomach. Those are patients that were randomized to periop, meaning 3 months pre and 3 months post of systemic therapy, typically ECF, which is epirubicin, cisplatin, and 5-FU versus, and it's important to understand the control arm in this was no chemotherapy at all. It's not post-op, it's not periop versus post-op or neoadjuvant versus post-op, it's periop versus none. So there was significant survival advantage in those patients. That doesn't necessarily mean that they benefited from the fact that it was neoadjuvant, but that they benefited from just having chemotherapy. So it's not really evidence to promote neoadjuvant therapy, but that's often the model that we use. Patients with, and it's important to assess whether they're N1 versus N2 nodes. N2 nodes have a much worse prognosis, has much more advanced disease, although those are still patients we treat in a neoadjuvant setting. If they have a good result, then we do proceed with surgery. So I think roughly speaking, just to sort of summarize, stage-specific treatment, early stage, upfront resection, local regional stage, neoadjuvant therapy, and then metastatic disease, purely palliative. So I think that would sort of address the issue of medical versus surgical, neo versus adjuvant. I think when you talk about gastric cancer, I think when you talk about sort of GI cancer overall, that probably the best prognosis is in combination of surgery and systemic therapy. So there aren't too many people, I don't think. Well, take that back. I think probably for very early stage gastric cancer, one might not use adjuvant chemotherapy. But for most patients in this country that we see that are candidates for curative intent resection, they're going to be candidates for chemotherapy, whether you give it pre or post. So that's mainly the question, whether you give it beforehand or afterwards. And I'd say a lot of the patients, at least that I've seen, were given neoadjuvant therapy. So, okay.
Great. So next question. So it comes up often in the reading that you can miss occult metastatic disease or peritoneal implants on your initial staging workup and your CT scan. So is it useful to do a diagnostic laparoscopy for everybody? Do you do it on all your patients or selectively?
Yeah, I tend to do it pretty much for everybody. There's a fair amount of data out of Memorial Sloan Kettering that sort of advocates for peritoneal washings. And peritoneal washings sent for cytology, if those are positive, and those patients tend to behave more like N1 patients, M1, so metastatic patients, those who have gross metastatic disease. So, I think it's reasonable to do a pre-op diagnostic laparoscopy, especially in patients that you think have node-positive disease or potentially more locally advanced disease, because a lot of times there can be occult, peritoneal-based disease that would significantly change your approach. Essentially, that would shift you from curative intent to a palliative type of paradigm. We won't mention HIPEC here. I think that's a little bit out of the box for peritoneal-based gastric cancer. But I'd say the accepted thinking on this is that carcinomatosis with gastric cancer is incurable, and that's metastatic disease, and you're in a palliative setting at that point.
Great. And then, so let's say you had a patient with early stage gastric cancer, and you went down the route of upfront surgical resection. How extensive a lymphadenectomy do you do? And this is a question that's been debated for a long time in different countries. So D1 versus a D2 more extensive resection.
Yeah. I think that for most people that treat this type of disease from a surgical standpoint, do an extended lymphadenectomy. Now, the traditional D2 dissection included a distal pancreatectomy and splenectomy, which is not routinely done. The morbidity And mortality, actually, from adding that to a total gastrectomy was significant in the clinical trials. So people shy away from doing a distal pancreatectomy and splenectomy. Having said that, I think most surgeons that treat this disease routinely, if you're doing curative intent resection, would do an extended lymphadenectomy. The actual extended lymphadenectomy does not in itself add that much morbidity. You're not taking out other adjacent organs. You're just doing a more extensive dissection. And in appropriate hands, that carries with it not a very much increased morbidity. So just to summarize in a nutshell what the difference between D1 and D2, it's basically based on a Japanese nodal system, gastric nodal system. And it's something that is worth potentially committing to memory if you're going to treat these patients. At least have some familiarity with it. Now, I don't know all the nodal stations, but the way I remember it is D1 dissection is the N1 nodes, D2 dissection is the N2 nodes. So the N1 nodes are going to be the ones that are perigastric, so ones just adjacent to the stomach. So, suprapyloric, infrapyloric, pericardial, along the lesser curve, and along the greater curve. When you talk about N2 nodes, they start being named after sort of more vascular structures. So we're talking about common hepatic artery, left gastric, splenic, celiac. Those are nodal stations 7, 8, and 9, I think. 10 is by the splenic hilum. Sort of 9 is along the splenic artery chain. And then there are hilar nodes along the hepatic artery, adjacent to the bile duct, posterior to the portal vein. And I believe those are in station 12. And then right gastrohypoploic. And there's going to be one that's at the base of the gastrohypoploic vein, which when it inserts into the supramedullary vein, that's station 14. And then one at the base of the gastrohypoploic artery, which comes off the gastroduodenal as it courses anterior to the pancreas and comes off the inferior border of the pancreas, turns into the gastroduodenal, right gastrohypoploic, and that's that nodal station. So you're doing a more extensive lymphadenectomy based on the vascular supply of the stomach and of the sort of regional vessels in that area. So I think of it anatomically as just being one step outside of sort of the perigastric nodes. Now, there's some thought in the Japanese literature about directing your lymphadenectomy based on the location of the tumor. So, if it's in the antrum, you do more extensive lymphadenectomy around the head of the pancreas versus up in the cardia. Now, I think for all intents and purposes in this country, you can think of a D2 dissection as just sort of D2 dissection. And that includes dissection of those nodes as well as a complete omentectomy, taking the omentum off of the transverse colon. And the other description is taking the anterior capsule off the pancreas, which sometimes is easy, sometimes it's not, but you want to take some of the tissue that's posterior to the stomach that's adherent to the retroperitoneum. And I think Dr. Corbera is going to do a technical talk about gastrectomy, in which he's probably going to go into detail about some of those issues as well.
Perfect. So that gave us a good bird's eye overview of how to treat this disease. Thank you, Dr. Rossi. We will see you next Wednesday in our session.